Welcome back to Beyond the Signal, the podcast where we go deep on the people, processes, and priorities shaping modern cybersecurity. Today's guest is Sandra Sexton, Director of Technology at Hondo ISD, who's lived the chaos of post-COVID digital transformation, fought to stretch every dollar of fading ESSER funds, and stood firm against rising threats without a Fortune 500 budget. In this episode, we dig into how one rural Texas school district is managing enterprise-scale risk with a team of just a few, why cyber insurance carriers are changing the rules of the game, and how Sandra's real-world incidents have reshaped her entire approach to resilience. If you're in education, security, or just navigating the pressure of doing more with less, this one's for you. Let's get into it. Thank you, Sandra, for joining us today. We're so glad to have you.
Great to be on. Thank you.
It's been 4 years since classrooms fully went remote. What challenges left by the rapid pivot are still on your desk today, and which have surprised you by getting harder instead of easier?
One of the biggest challenges we had with COVID was the rapid expansion of online resources and social media promoting, go sign up for anything. You know, all these companies offered free. And so schools were left scrambling. And so that created some issues in the approval of software and due diligence on the privacy and the security of the accounts. And so basically the approval process and making sure all the due diligence is done before it's tried in the classroom took a little while. And the other issue that it's really changed is it's a lot harder to get that free trial to see if it's a really good fit for the classroom, because so many companies really did get abused during COVID, offering out free trials of their enterprise. So a lot of that has been reduced in what's available to schools.
I mean, even companies like ours, we offer free proof of value, but you still have people that have to go through and give those approvals. So I completely understand that difficulty. Legislators often hand down cybersecurity mandates without matching dollars. How do you triage which requirements get immediate investment and which become longer term projects?
For us, it's all about risk management. So we have to take a look and see what records are actually affected, whether it's actually impacting student records or student privacy, followed then by staff and teacher, and also sometimes just the sheer number of records. So sometimes the product that's involved changes the risk factor for that.
Have you found creative ways to translate compliance language into outcomes teachers and principals actually care about?
When I talk to, it doesn't matter what level, whether it's teachers or whether it's our school board, I put it into terms of protecting our student data, that we are the gateway that is keeping the bad actors from actually accessing enrollment data for our students and for our parents of our students, that we really have to take an active role. We can't rely on just firewalls and antivirus. We have to take an active role in this day of phishing emails.
Absolutely. I think a lot of people can take the humanity out of cybersecurity at times and think, oh, well, it's just because my network is insecure, things like that. But they don't think about the fact that behind that, there are students who will carry that data all through the school systems, through their entire education. And it takes one time for that to end up being a much bigger problem for them and for their parents.
Well, and it's also the fact that schools are mandated to keep records for past graduates as well. So that greatly increases the risk factor of how many records. And the other issue, especially post-COVID, is how much is now done off your network and how much is done from home. So if you're relying on traditional firewall rules and traditional like DNS, then the minute they leave your network and they're on their own home internet, you still have to have additional in place that doesn't matter where they're connected anymore. And that was a very big shift for schools, because schools didn't really have a work from home. Schools really didn't have a lot of push to do things outside the classroom. It was very much a walled garden kind of network design.
I can imagine. I have kids and we have the issue all the time where now it's not like a day off of school. If something is an issue, it's a remote learning day. It's moved away from just a day off and we do makeup days. No, we're not making it up. It's all remote now.
It's all remote. Everything can still go in the Google Classroom and the work can continue. And then it's just a reteach option.
With ESSER funds expiring, what's your strategy for sustaining the tech gains they paid for, especially when hardware refresh cycles collide with budget cuts?
This is something that schools are still struggling with. because ESSER and the push for remote learning greatly expanded the technology needs in the school districts. And so now with ESSER funds gone and then a lot of schools facing budget cuts because of declining enrollment, it's really like a double whammy. So for my district personally, we've really developed a robust obsolescence plan and we're having to stay very faithful to that. Plus we're doing a lot more repairs in-house and trying to get that last mile out of all of our devices.
It's so much different than when I was younger. They weren't sending laptops home or tablets or any of these things. So those extra endpoints just really added another source of complexity for everything.
You know, Chromebooks have really been a big win for school districts because you get the same platform and you get that conformity across. So that's really, really helped. Plus you get, you know, the admin console plus all the security logs built in. So that's been a real game changer for schools.
From smart boards to student-issued Chromebooks, the campus feels more like a small city almost. What part of that ecosystem keeps you up at night right now and why?
Personally, right now, it's the fiscal responsibility of keeping it all going because you now end up with more devices on campus than you actually have students. And so because you have, you know, you do a shared cart system or you do a one-to-one, plus then you have several devices for your teachers from their classroom panel to their laptop, just trying to keep it fiscally managed and trying to be ahead of what we think the curve is going to be in 5 to 10 years. Because that's the whole problem, that technology changes so fast and we have a very limited budget, we're having to guess what we need before that hits end of life.
For sure. And as far as things like cyber insurance, premiums are climbing and the questionnaires are brutal. How have carrier requirements reshaped your security roadmap? Helpful guardrails or are they an expensive distraction?
For me personally, they were very helpful because I had been telling my superintendent at the time and my school board and my teachers that we needed to enforce MFA, that I knew that was going to be a process we had to work for because we have a lot of staff that have reservations about tying it to their personal device, rightfully so. But in order to keep the entire district safer, we needed to have MFA in. And so I'd been having those discussions my first year in Hondo, and then we got our cyber insurance questionnaire. And the very first on there is, have you implemented MFA? And the carrier flat out told my superintendent, if you check no to that, we won't carry you. So it was 100% the teeth I needed to implement what I knew we needed for framework.
It's always good when it's something that you've been trying to explain and then eventually it's like, well, we can't have it if you don't put it in place. So sometimes those the insurance carriers that at times feel like, gosh, this is so daunting, it ends up being something to help you make your case. So that it's good that worked out that way. In a district where wired, wireless, and cloud traffic all blend together, what signals do you rely on most to separate normal student activity from genuine threats without drowning your team in alerts?
To be perfectly honest, we rely most on our alerts that are coming from our internet filter, because when we're talking about student traffic and we have a child that is trying to search for ways to get around the internet filter, that's where they're going to run into things that are malicious. And so we try and intervene when they first start. And then past that, if any alerts that are coming from our antivirus, our EDR, plus then we are part of MS ISAC's malicious domain blocking system. So anything that comes from there, we take very, very robust.
Like looking back at being in high school and being in the library and trying to go play video games or other things instead of doing what I was supposed to be doing. Not that I wasn't an ideal student. You don't think of the security implications of it back at those points because they're just kids trying to do things that they'd want to do, watch YouTube videos. And
nine times of what they're trying to get around the filter for is to play a game or to watch an unapproved YouTube video. It's usually a game walkthrough. At schools, we have the network that's the size of a small to medium business, maybe even a large business, depending on the size of the district. And we have to protect our network not only from malicious actors outside, but we also have to protect our network from our own staff and students. And unlike a company that gets to fire an employee that makes the wrong choice or violates an AUP at schools, we have to keep them. And we have to put that device back in their hand the very next day so they can get their work done or they can learn. and they can access their textbooks with everything being online. The days of taking away their internet access are gone.
Absolutely. You can't say, well, you're expelled, can't go to school because you did something that you didn't realize was going to cause a problem. So K-12 IT teams are famously lean. What workflows or tool combinations have helped you cut investigation time when something pops up on an endpoint or SaaS app after hours?
For my district, we're very ad hoc on that because it depends where the alert is coming from, who we actually mobilize. So if it's coming from our internet filter and it's a security alert, then we can remotely shut down the Chromebook if we need to. If it's more like it's coming from our filter, but it's a student's health and wellness, then we have a great relationship with support inside our county that can get the child support. If it's coming from our EDR and it's a true cybersecurity alert, we have a great partnership with our regional service center and with some, and they can help coordinate and get in some government help for us. So it's more about when alert comes in, especially after hours, it's more about verifying it's not a false positive to verify it's actually true, and then marshaling the correct support. We can get the intervention started then and not wait until 7:30 in the next morning.
The dwell time of a bad actor is really something that's so important. And I know a lot of companies that deal with this and don't have that 24/7 support or someone they can reach out to. I think it's the average dwell time ends up being 22 days before somebody realizes what's going on.
Well, and a lot of schools are under attack, especially during holidays, because they know how lean the staff is. They know how many hours the staff puts in already. And so they know for the most part, you know, during school holidays, especially extended school holidays, they can, if they can manage to get a foothold, they have a few days before. So those after, the after hour on call is really important.
Absolutely. So without naming names, can you walk us through an incident or a near miss that fundamentally changed how you think about resilience?
I actually have two. One went through a major cybersecurity incident, and they were very open after the fact about what that was like from the inside. And so they brought up things that I needed to incorporate into my emergency operation plans that I had not thought about. Like in order for their cyber insurance to pay, they had to actually go in and rip out every hard drive that they had and seal them for evidence. So they then had to go and buy brand new hard drives, clone everything over. In the middle of trying to get everything up, they were dealing with that kind of, I was not aware at that point. I just had not thought that deep into it. I'd been thinking about from a cybersecurity, how would we get our services back up and going? And it made me reach out to my cyber insurance and go, okay, if we have an event, what should we do to where we don't invalidate the payout? And so that incorporated talking to cybersecurity insurance a lot sooner in the process, because we had to use their investigators, and there are certain things that we could do and certain things that they had to send their own forensic expert out in order to do. So I was able to take what had happened to that other district and then get with my cybersecurity insurance to create a more robust emergency plan that wouldn't require me being the only one that would know how to run it. Because that was very good advice that we received, that it needs to be run to where it is not just me running through the steps, because most likely I'm going to be in a closet somewhere and other people need to be tasked with actually talking to the cybersecurity insurance, the lawyers, the media, and things like that. I hadn't thought that far deep into it because I'd been focusing on the technical aspects. So that was a different viewpoint for the emergency operation plan. And then the second one that I had was another school district that was very open about their issue that they had and the fact that it was an inventory control issue. And so they thought they had everything cleaned and everything upgraded and everything fixed and everything off, but they had allowed a teacher to keep a secondary device when they got their new one in order to transfer everything over. And they did not realize that it had never been turned back in. Then he brought it to campus, you know, 2 or 3 weeks later, after getting the all clear. And the minute that one came back on, it reinfected everything. And that was a new emphasis put on inventory control that I had not seen the impact of other than the cybersecurity framework. So that's something that I can now point to whenever I have a pushback on how tight we need to keep our inventory control.
One that's scary just to think about how it's like, okay, yeah, just keep it for a little while, transfer your stuff over and you're all good. And then something big like that happening. It's good, though, that your fellow ISDs can talk to each other and do that kind of knowledge sharing. This is a teaching experience. This is a learning experience because you guys are running with small IT teams. So it's not like you have the bandwidth or the time to think about every single thing that could go wrong.
Or
so
even
that's
the training. I mean, because the vast majority of school IT people are like myself. I came in from the classroom to become IT. I don't have a degree in cybersecurity. There wasn't such a thing when I was in college. So everything that I've learned has been self-management and learning from peers and a lot of self-study. And so there's always more to learn. And so hearing from other school districts and doing that share of knowledge, because the risks that education face is very, very different than what your corporate environment faces.
So when it comes to the school board, and they want assurance, but the superintendent wants cost savings, how do you translate that cyber risk into a language that can resonate with both of them?
I'm very lucky in all the school districts I've been a part of to have very supportive school boards, because part of that is when they go to their training with their summer training with TASB and their continuing education, they are now including cybersecurity in part of their continuing education. So part of that is just being very open and honest with them about what we have in place, how much it costs, and also the potential risks. So whenever there is a breach from, you know, another school district or a company we do business with, they have an understanding of what that risk is and what that compares to what the future liability would be for the district if there was ever a future breach. So they are very, very supportive of all preventative. And that's the whole message that I keep giving them. We need to spend the vast majority of our time and effort on preventing versus remediation, because by then the data's already out.
Especially when you've got stories like the hardware replacement and all of that, you can go back and lean on and say the cost of this breach would be so much more monumental than the investment in making sure that we're safer now. So that's always such a good thing to be able to relate both of those to each other.
The same language I use when we talk about purchasing software, what the cost per pupil is. Because when you're looking at purchasing software for the district, you look at, you know, how many students are it serving, and that gives you your cost per pupil. And that gives you an idea when you're talking about, oh, it's campus license or district license. It evens the playing field and you get to see how expensive that software actually is. Well, when you do that, you hear these large numbers of payouts that these other districts are having or these companies are having. So if we translate that also into a payout per pupil, then that gives it a base that makes more sense to the C-level.
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. And I think that's a really good thing for other organizations that may not be thinking about it that way, that may hopefully hear this podcast to have that baseline to work with. With growing cybersecurity talent inside K-12, it can feel like training folks just in time for them to leave for higher paying roles. How are you tackling retention and upskilling?
I'm very fortunate being where I'm located. There's not a lot of competition that for the most part, if they want to come work for the school, they're doing it for other reasons. They want to be of service. They want to work with the students. They want to be, they want to support the community and the school district, because the school district is such a large part of our rural community. And if they were really interested in the money, they wouldn't be coming here. They would be driving into San Antonio every day. So for me, it's not more about the retention. For me, it's the upskilling. It has to be on the job training march. So we've spent basically, if anybody on my team wants to further their education and get certifications, then we find a way to get them that skill, whether that's self-paced online or I'm sending them to training. It's more like, what are they interested in learning next that supports the district? So it's more an upskilling process. And unfortunately, it's finding the time for them to actually take the classes. That's the biggest barrier.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a blessing and a curse almost to have a smaller organization, but such a blessing that you've got people there who really are there because they want to be, not just because it's something that they feel is like, oh, it's quick money, or it's something that they're passionate about. So I want to end this with just a couple of quick fire questions. What is the biggest myth that you'd like to bust about K-12 cybersecurity?
They won't pick on schools because we're broke. That is really changing. School districts and K-12 are a growing target for bad actors, and the size doesn't keep you safe anymore.
What's one metric that you wish every district tracked, but most don't?
That's a good question. It's really hard to say what other districts track because I know that they have tools that will track like their alerts. But for me, I really wish they would keep more of track on their education component, their cybersecurity training, and not only the completion rate of their cybersecurity training, but also how that translates into phishing tests and what their failure rate of their phishing tests is.
That is super important. Okay, so my last question is advice to your 2020 self in one sentence.
To stop thinking that things will go back to normal, that this is the new normal, and it's only going to change even more rapidly in the cybersecurity world with the advent of AI. For years, I've been telling my staff and my students that they're the first and last defense of the network because it's not computers it's computers hacking computers now. And so that's going to be, so their length of their password, the complexity in using a password sentence, and really not multitasking through their emails and actually paying attention and stopping and thinking before they interact with the email. But it's rapidly going to change with the advent of AI, because the old red flags that you could use to train people on are rapidly changing. Because like you said, they're not going to be misspellings anymore. They're going to look more and more like legitimate emails, down to exact copies of legitimate emails. So it's going to make it a lot harder. And I'd go back and tell myself to be ready for the new normal and not to spend so much time wishing things had gone back pre-COVID.
Well, those are all of the questions I had for you. I just want to thank you so much for your time today and for sharing your insights with us.
Thank you.
That's a wrap on this episode of Beyond the Signal. Huge thanks to Sandra Sexton for giving us a candid look inside the trenches of K-12 cybersecurity. If today's conversation made you think differently about resilience, risk, or what it really means to protect the network, do us a favor. Share this episode, leave a review, and check out our other interviews with security leaders across education, healthcare, critical infrastructure, and beyond. Until next time, stay sharp, stay skeptical, and keep looking beyond the signal.